Support for this program is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
The Local Thread.
Welcome back to Toledo Works. I'm Jaden Jefferson, and my next guest is going to be a familiar voice to many of you, London Mitchell. He's joining me from the Toledo History Museum, and I want to talk a little bit today about you and the museum, but first and foremost, how did you go from radio to the museum? How did that happen?
Well, I think I've always been intrigued by Toledo history, and Toledo's my hometown. It's been very good to me and my family over the years. I've worked in a profession that I've loved. Never once did I wake up and think, oh, God, I got to go to work today. And as you get involved in the news media and covering stories, you learn that there's always a story before the story.
Right.
And a story before the story before. And that has always intrigued me about Toledo. And so when I was approached about joining the board at the Toledo History Museum, I said, "Yeah, let's see what that's all about." And I've really got to the point where I'm really intrigued by the history of my hometown. A lot of it that I did not know, and Jaden, I think, and I'm not all that familiar with you, but I think Toledo's your hometown too.
It
correct?
Is, yeah.
And a lot of the people that I meet, in fact, I'd say the majority of the people that I meet that are hometowners, and you start talking about Toledo, they feel almost embarrassed to say, "Hey, I'm from Toledo." You know, I think it's because they don't really know what they're talking about. Honestly, for some reason, Toledo as a whole has not, in my opinion, really worked at its reputation, at its image.
Telling its story.
And when you look at some of the really historic things that have happened in Toledo, and I'll go back to one back in the mid-30s, the terrible strike, labor strike at Autolite. And many historians will say that was the moment in history that triggered the start of the UAW. That's significant. Or you say to yourself, well, you know, Toledo was one of the biggest railheads in the country at one time, late 1800s, early 1900s. That helped open up the country. Significant. We were a significant player. And when you stop to think of the people that built Toledo, even after the Depression, they still had this vision of building a world-class art museum, a world-class zoo, one of the best metro park systems.
Yeah.
Not to mention keeping the port alive and active. I think there's a lot here that once you start really looking at what Toledo has to offer, I think you can say, "Hey, let's learn the stories behind the stories."
And there's a through line here from news to a history museum because, again, it's about telling stories. And looking at Toledo's story, it has not always done a good job of actually telling the world what has taken place here and what has occurred here. And so in your time with the history museum, what are some different moments that surprised you that you personally didn't know as a native?
Well, I think when we started to look at the automotive industry, that was an exhibit that was on display at our little museum. When I first joined, I didn't realize that at one point, Toledo was the second largest producer of automobiles in the country. That really surprised me. And the people that came to Toledo, the Stranahans building Champion Spark Plug, and Libby with the glass, they came here because the auto industry was here. Okay? And how Toledo, you know, was a mover and shaker, that really kind of surprised me. I did not know that, and it really made me want to dig deeper into the history. Now, we've closed that exhibit. The Toledo History Museum is temporarily closed while we bring in new things. And many of the new things we're bringing in reflect the industrial part of Toledo's history back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Things that were created and produced in Toledo that really kind of had an effect on the lifestyle of American families. And, you know, a lot of people know about Toledo scale, but we're looking at things as simple as baby buggies to electric ranges. A lot of things that, what? You said this was created in Toledo?
A part of Toledo in every home, essentially.
Really? I think that's a good way to look at it. Now, as a prelude to that, we've taken the idea that we want to take the museum out to where people are. And the first step we took was to create an interactive program, an interactive exhibit, if you would, online that reflects this Made in Toledo kind of motif. And so you can go to our website and for no charge, just walk yourself through this interactive exhibit. It talks about who the movers and shakers were, what they created, the impact of these, how many people were employed. Toledo was a hell of a manufacturing community.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize how many factories, how much was going on prior to the Great Depression. So I think going back and looking at all these items online kind of triggers your interest to actually see these things. Many of them, to my understanding, have never been on display in Toledo before.
Hmm.
And so I don't know. That's a long answer to a short question.
Well, I find it fascinating because there are times where I will be downtown and I will just kind of look around and think about Toledo of the past. And it's, you know, it's easy to reminisce on the past, especially when you aren't there, me being one of those people. But I think about it because Toledo, it was this boom town. And I kind of liken it to how you look at Columbus today, which is a massive city that's only growing. Are there some things that stick out to you about that time in Toledo history that maybe is unique to Toledo's story?
Well, I think that some of the things that happened in Toledo, and I don't want to point fingers, that's not. But let me tell you something that a story, and maybe it's urban myth, maybe it's not. But a relative of mine that was a real student of Toledo history said that one time shortly after the turn of the century, a young man came to Toledo and he said, boy, you've got water and you've got highways, you know, trails crossing this way and that way, and you've got the port. I want to build my new factory in Toledo. I've got this new idea. Here's where I want to build it. Now, back in those days, right around the turn of the century, Toledo, and most people probably don't know this, was one of the major producing areas of bicycles. And city fathers, there were no city mothers back in those days, all city fathers, right, believed that the future of Toledo, what was going to stamp Toledo on the country, was bicycles. So Henry Ford decided he would build elsewhere. Now, if that's a true story, and I've heard it from multiple sources that, you know, we didn't become the home of Ford.
Darn
but,
it.
But I think it shows where maybe Toledo leaders have been a little too conservative in their thinking over the years and didn't do a lot of long-range thought.
Right.
You know, Toledo was here. Toledo had the inspirations all there. I think maybe the leadership was a little short-sighted in its long-range planning. I can't say that. I'm not a historian. I'm more of a storyteller kind of person. But I do believe that that you could go back. And I think, too, you know, my alma mater, the University of Toledo, here in Toledo. And there was a time, and today too, but back when I was going to the University of Toledo, I mean, Toledo is my hometown. I went to the university. I could graduate from the university, find a job.
Yeah.
You know, we had several Fortune 500 companies headquartered right here. And a lot of people did that. They went to college. They got their job. They had their careers, never left the city.
And now things have changed.
Now things have changed. But if you look back, Jaden, think of yourself, how different your behavior would be if you were always near mom and dad or grandma and grandpa or your uncles and aunts. You kind of behave a little more conservatively. You think a little more conservatively than if you went away to Athens and you were at a big party school and a lot of liberal thinking, or you went out west, or you right away joined the military. I think that the conservative thinking was kind of inbred in Toledo.
Perhaps a bit stifling.
Yeah, I think maybe. Now, that's just a theory I have. I have no concrete evidence, and I can't give you any experts to talk about. But when you look back at what Toledo had from the early railroad days to the manufacturing to the cultural offerings that this city has, I think you can be proud to be in Toledo. And that's what I envision the Toledo History Museum being, is not just a collection of things, but a way to get you interested in Toledo's history and culture and heritage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and how do you go about acquiring those stories? Because many of the primary sources, they aren't going to be here to tell those stories themselves. And so where do you find the information, and where do you connect with those things that maybe most people aren't already familiar with?
Good question. Good question. And I think that you would be surprised at how many people have held on to stories and literature about those old days. The Toledo Public Library local history department is an excellent source.
For sure.
Of digging into things. And when we have an exhibit, I'll just take this old electric range that we have pulled out and we're putting on display to go back and look at the name and find out, well, was it manufactured in Toledo? Where? And you can start looking and piecing together a lot of the interwoven facts about who created this. Why did they produce in Toledo? What was there about Toledo that was really, really interesting? A good story, too, is that Toledo really had the first radio-dispatched police car. We've got that story on our website. The offer went to Detroit. Detroit didn't have any money. Toledo said, "Yeah, we'll experiment with that." that's a really good story. I think one of the other stories that we have on our website, which is ToledoHistoryMuseum.org, is a story about radio, which really intrigued me, that the first voice communication on radio that actually went from one room to another room or one building to another building happened in Toledo.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of stuff that if you just tickle some interest, you can find, like I said, the story behind the story or the stories that are networked with each other.
And I know this is true of me. It sounds like it's true of you, that when you're looking, it's not exactly that you're looking for something, but it really finds you when you're trying to determine what is relevant to Toledo's story. Because I know a little bit of internet research, you'll just come across things that maybe you've just never heard before. Is that true of most of your work?
Yes, yes. And it just points out something that I have considered amazing. 50-plus years I've been working in Toledo Broadcasting, so I've been along for the opening of the Internet and the World Wide Web, and it astounds me how fast it grew. And there's nothing you can't find online anymore. And when you stop to think, how is it that something could grow so fast that so many people had so much interest in putting their knowledge or their companies or their organizations online? It just grew so fast, and now we have such a fantastic resource. It's great.
Yeah. What would you say would be some of the key takeaways from Toledo history as we look to build Toledo's future?
I think if we look at Toledo's history and we look at some of the people that were really involved, and I call them movers and shakers, but anywhere from Golden Rule Jones, one of our early mayors, to the giants like Libby and Owens and Stranahan, they all had vision. And they all took it upon themselves to move those visions forward. And I think if we ever get to a point where we say, oh, golly, it's just Toledo, there's no future here. The future is what you build yourself. The future is open. The resources are here. You just have to look at the history. And I know I'm probably sounding like I work for the Chamber of Commerce, but you asked, and I see my hometown as a place where opportunity exists, and it's proven to us throughout history. Toledo was not a boom town. There was no gold here. There was no silver here. But we had resources that people could see and understand, like the port.
Yeah.
Like our location and a workforce and a pioneer spirit. A friend of mine, if I could just mention this real quickly, Ted Long has written a book, 1856, and it talks about how Toledo really became that vital frontier city and the spirit of Toledoans to build their community and build their city. It's an interesting read, and I think it reflects on your question and kind of my sales pitch answer.
And this is going to be a lightning question just because we have so little time, but do you think that visionary spirit still exists here in Toledo today?
Oh, boy, you really backed me into a corner on that one. You know, I don't know, to be honest with you. I think that in some areas, I think that there is a lot of leadership in some of our cultural things like the zoo and the metro parks. And we have some really great facilities like the Museum of the Great Lakes that are parked here. And so I think that there are people that see Toledo as a place for the future.
London Mitchell of the Toledo History Museum, thanks for coming
on
the show.
Thank you.
Hello, welcome to Toledo Works, hosted by WGTE and Toledo Free Press. I'm your host, Steven Zenner, here talking with local artists. We're talking to artists today on Toledo Works, and my first guest is Jay Dickerson, or as he's AKA'd, Dirty Kicks. How are you doing, Jay?
Yeah, I'm doing okay.
Yeah, as good as you can be. So you're a published photographer. You've been published in the New York Times, a number of different large publications. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, you won a top spot with some of the nation's top photo editors, and you've kind of had a good run with your photography work. And you're a documentary photographer. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. But you also do some galleries. You show your work sometimes, but you're also published in different things. What got you into documentary photography?
I mean, that's always a question that I reflect on time and time again, because I grew up around photography indirectly through my father, but my like whole passion really was ignited maybe when I would take my kids to school and I would kind of like walk around the city. At that time, like, their mother and I were separating, so it was like having an addictive personality, I didn't want to rely on the things that other people have relied on or like, you know, pass the time or whatever. So, you know, walking around downtown Toledo, just killing some time, you know, while they were in school, I would just meet like random folks on the street, you know, unhoused population, commuters, like I would meet just everyone just kind of chilling, you know. And at that point, it wasn't really about photography because, you know, as any photographer knows, like you kind of start out like photographing everything. So when I went and, you know, just kind of like started taking those long walks, I didn't know what to focus on. But like the cool thing about Instagram, when Instagram was like a godsend for photographers way back when, was that I started to see and learn what street photography was. Mm-hmm. And I tried to apply some of the stuff that I would see there to like what I was experiencing here in Toledo. But I started to hit gold when I would wrap up these conversations with people and like ask for a photograph, which is so intimidating for an introvert like I am, you know?
Right.
But it was cool. So like the documentary stuff really, it started to take off once I started to explore. Like the street photography stuff is cool, but like when you start to peel back the layers of the people around you, like it's, there's just so much, you know, there's so much to a human being. So the passion for that really came probably like year two. Then everything went crazy.
And that makes perfect sense to me because when you're a street photographer, you could be doing it anywhere.
Right.
You're just kind of catching people anywhere. But you're talking about how after a year, you actually started to think about it differently than street photography, which is kind of what documentary photography is.
It's right.
Going a little bit deeper, going back to the same communities, going back into the same areas to make those connections and to document life. And how did that kind of emerge? You said that, you know, after a year or two, you started to have some recognition. Is that, how did that happen?
Yeah. I mean, I still question that. You know, again, the practice was, how should I start? So like the notice just came with the growth of Instagram. But during that period, like even to this day, like you could look at my beginnings and up until where I'm at right now on there, because I used to drive around using my cell phone, taking pictures, which was crazy. And I never suggest for anyone to do that, but it was like, I would blindly shoot just to see what I would come up with because I was trying to understand digital photography at the time. Mm-hmm. And I find that digital photography is incredibly slow. There's probably someone that's cringing at me saying that because you can get 4,000, you know, seconds or seconds on there. But it's all of the moving parts. And my frustrations with digital photography kind of were born from there. And so while I was like, I guess my discovery really like took off once I like switched to film and I was able to like think less about what goes on inside the camera and more about the people. And then I was able to like ask questions, and there was this documentary that I watched, and I always like kind of start my year off called Everybody Street, and you can find it on like YouTube and a couple other spots. But it was like all of these artists that are like diehard photographers, and the things that they understood and the things that they shared were things that I felt about the people that I would encounter. So like, I really started to notice things when I honed in on how downtown life was in Toledo, where the folks coming from the outside, living in, you know, Perrysburg, Rossford, all of that stuff, whenever they would roam downtown Toledo, they kind of kept to their own spaces, but there wasn't any engagement with the people who were like catching a bus or just trying to make ends meet. Like there, it was a clear line of segregation there. So I, you know, once I noticed that there was like certain parts of the downtown area I stayed away from because I figured it was like not worth the conversation. But I like locked in with the people that I needed to lock in with, and things kind of, again, they kept growing from there. So,
right, right. Yeah. And when you say you steered clear of areas of downtown, you're talking about more of the touristy areas.
Right.
Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, because it was, I mean, I don't want to say those people were boring. It was just like they're putting on a face, man. So I just want like the everyday person that's like not, you know, unapologetically them, you know? Mm. And so that expanded into just the different neighborhoods, like the neighborhoods people would deem unsavory in Toledo, or the neighborhoods I grew up in and were biking through and doing all these things as a kid. So as I like studied the history of photography and really like dove into Black and Latino photographers, the Bronx Documentary Center out in the Bronx is like one of my favorite points of reference. Again, things just kept growing for me. And I'm a person of like trial and error. So I'm like completely self-taught in all these respects. But it's, yeah, it was just a thing. And like the everyday people are the most satisfying folks, you know.
As you've gotten to know these different communities, you've kind of highlighted them. You've brought them a larger platform.
Yep.
People have kind of been able to recognize you even by your camera. What's the name of your camera that you?
The Rolleiflex.
The Rolleiflex.
Yeah.
And yeah. So that's a interesting camera to choose in the 21st century. What, you know, you mentioned that the film kind of was able to get you a better interaction with people. You were able to focus more on people with the film. What kind of went along with that choice? Because you said you started with the phone,
digital.
With the digital. And I think that's not necessarily outside of the norm for what's happening in photography right now.
Right.
But that does occupy a very specific niche
right.
that's going on in photography right now.
Yeah. It's a film. It's interesting, right? Because like having a digital camera would trigger all types of anxiety because I would always question, you know, if I had the right lens or the settings or something. And like one of the disciplines that I hold to this day, if I'm forced to be in a situation where I have to use a digital camera, I only allow myself to take one or two photographs and I don't look at any of the work. So I could have dropped the ball on a shot, but it's like, yo, you live and you learn. But with film, I'm able to just like, I trust myself with what I do. So I know the challenges, the nuances. It's like that person that has their favorite pencil and they could create so many shades, right? Like you know, like this pencil, what it can do for you on different types of paper and different types of settings. And the same thing is how I relate to film. I know the shots that other people may feel like they would drop the ball on is a shot that I'm going to get with this camera that's from 1957 and it's a fixed lens. So I'm the zoom. I have to move my body and engage. So placing those type of challenges in front of me helped me grow as an artist. Because the digital camera was just like, I mean, I'm not mad at digital, right? Like I have to use it every so often, but I put like limitations and I just hate my work when it's digital. It's like, it's, you know, it might be cool for the audience, but it just doesn't touch me the way that, you know, my Rolleiflex does.
Right. Is it the handmade quality? I'm trying to kind of zone in on that use because I know that it's a very intentional choice that you make. What about like the product of film? Because film one film is expensive now.
Yeah, it is. So, I mean, I do hustle, but yeah, it is. I mean, it's I like the pleasant surprises of knowing that I got the shot. You know, like that. The time between taking the photograph and then going through the development stages and letting the film dry and digitizing it and all of that stuff or printing it in my dark room, like all of that stuff is, there's a satisfaction that comes with that I don't receive from like a digital camera. Cause like taking a photograph and immediately seeing it within seconds, I just don't understand how you can grow. You know, and again, this is not a diss at digital photographers. I think digital photographers have their own challenges that they place in front of them in order for them to grow, right? But for me, it was like, yo, I'm not trying to buy a bunch of lenses or think about the next camera body. Like, I just want this one thing that does three things, and that's it, you know? Yeah. So, like, the film, the film is, I guess, just the, like, I don't have anything specific to say necessarily about being, like, a black or white photographer or even just dabbling in color. It's just, it's that one thing that helps me communicate with folks, you know? Mm. So, like, yeah. I'm going to pause on that because I'll go on a tangent, man. Because, no, y'all, I used to get so irritated when people would be like, you know, it's the tones, it's this, it's that. It's like, dude, don't amp this experience up to be what it is. Like, understand why those tones come about or why this happens or why that happens. So it's like, I'm not going to listen to the dude that shot three rolls of this particular film. I'm going to listen to the person that shot 3,000 rolls of that particular film, you know, because they know the nuances the way I know the nuances.
Yeah. So, as you said, it's all in service to getting in touch with this community.
Right.
And from what I've seen, there's not a whole lot of other people kind of documenting just the everyday life of the neighborhoods and the parts of Toledo that you would go into. Right. What are some of the things that you initially kind of, the victories that you kind of, I guess, had with interacting with people in the community, but also I know there's been some challenges as well.
Just telling stories. I mean, I've shared this before, I don't think in a podcast setting, but just with like friends or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like one of the coolest things I experienced was there was this woman that accidentally sent me a message on Instagram that was intended for a friend of hers. And she, in this message, was like, you know, you should follow this guy. He shows a different side of Toledo that I feel like I'll never interact with.
And what a gift. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was cool, but she accidentally sent it to me. And this was before you could like unsend something. So she had to like bite the bullet. And I appreciated it, you know, because when you're doing that, it's such an isolating. Photography is like so isolating, right? Like, until I meet someone, like when I go out on these walks, like, dude, there's so many blocks where it's just me and nature, you know, but then I pay attention to the sidewalks. I pay attention to people's yards. Like I pay attention to all of those things and just the changes that come about. But like, it's a solitary experience until I like encounter someone. And I'm, like I said, I'm introverted. I'm shy. Like, so I'm measuring energy and all of these different things before I like say what's up to someone, you know, and see where the conversation goes. But again, just when people are able to share their stories with me or whatever, and however I'm able to like platform that, like, I think it's cool. Cause it's not about me. Like, it's always about like what they share. Cause like in my times of need, I've always wanted an ear. So for me, like being a listener is like that's my takeaway, that's my pleasure. Like, it's just like helping somebody out if they need to get something off their chest, you know what I'm saying? So
and you mentioned that you're an introvert. A lot, I find a lot of photographers are introverted, but what is it about the camera that allows you to, you know, this isn't like you're reading a book or you're not like off with a long lens. The Rolleiflex is I don't know if it's, is it a 28 or is
35? Okay. Yeah, 35. So field of view.
So that's getting you pretty up and close with people that you may not know. Why would you do that as an introvert?
I guess that adrenaline rush, man. Like it's it's kind of cool to accomplish that or to like sometimes if I like meet some strangers, I can't help but to smile because I'm like, yo, this is actually happening. And I've done this so many times, but I'm still in that space where I'm like, yo, this is actually happening.
And what is that? Can you kind of define, because like I'm also a photographer, so I know what you mean. Like, but like, what is the moment?
That moment, I mean, it's euphoric for sure, but it's just like talking to someone and, you know, because I'm like, I'm on their time, right? Like, I'm taking a moment of their day or whatever. And so it's like, this conversation can go left or right. So like that moment when I say, like, would you mind if I like photograph you or whatever? And they say yes, it's like, all right, that's my first shot of the day. You know, like, this is the Hennessy at 4 p.m. Like, it's something, you know? So it's like, you know, having that accomplishment is, it's cool and it's rewarding, man. Because, you know, with me having this camera, and I mean, even if it was a digital camera, like it doesn't matter, but like I'm committed to I'm just committed to that, like that practice. And so I challenge myself to live my passion out as best as I can.
Yeah. And you've been able to get your work into a number of galleries around town, and right. you've had it even nationally. Where can people find your work?
Right now, my website is www.dirtykicks.com. One cool thing that I'm doing right now, I've been reaching out to people via Reddit and Craigslist and stuff, trying to set up portrait sessions. You know, this is expanded into like your Hollands, your Mommies, and all those places. So that's been a cool little side project. But galleries right now, I don't have anything, just because I've tried to clear my plate just to like focus back on like the people, because I was a little too busy.
Excellent. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much, James Dickerson, aka Dirty Kicks.
Yeah, appreciate
you. Well, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Toledo Works from the Toledo Free Press and WGTE Public Media. I'm Jaden Jefferson. Joining me now is Tanya Scherf, who is the executive director of Food for Thought. Tanya, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to first start, for those unfamiliar with Food for Thought, what is some of the work that your organization does in the community, and how did you get involved?
So Food for Thought has been around for nearly 20 years now. We started very simply handing out peanut butter and jelly sandwiches downtown Toledo in 2007. And that turned into a full-scale lunch offering and hot coffee. The most important thing about this distribution is that we create a safe space and community for people who need it. So we're serving 250 bagged lunches every single Saturday morning. And when I say every Saturday, I mean every single Saturday, no matter the weather, the holiday, we are down there serving people in need. And a few years after that started, we launched into a mobile food pantry program, because we discovered that the need for food existed outside of downtown Toledo. It existed in a lot of other areas. So we pack up carts of food on our trailer, and we have pantry partners throughout the city, and we unload groceries and serve anyone who's in need or wants to shop with us. But although there's a lot of food pantries in the area, a couple things that make Food for Thought different is that we don't ask people to qualify. So we serve anyone that comes to our food pantry with a photo ID. A lot of families we're serving now actually don't qualify for the SNAP program. They're making just a little too much to get assistance, but they're still struggling to keep up with the rising cost of everything. So that is really what drew me to Food for Thought. I've been doing nonprofit work for 25 plus years, but my parents divorced when I was a teenager, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom at the time. And so her getting a job and trying to keep us in a good school district, every month it was less and less assistance that we were getting. And we could have really used a place like Food for Thought that didn't have any questions, that just let us come in and pick the groceries we needed. So that's what I think drew me to Food for Thought more than anything.
And you make an important point there, which is that this is a public policy issue as well, because there are some people who simply are not covered by the social safety net. And it's been this gap that exists. And at the same time, this is a country with a $30 trillion gross domestic product, GDP, there are people every day who still go to bed without a full meal.
Yeah.
And so what do you make of that? And what are some of the things that you would like to see change, whether legislatively or policy-wise?
So I don't think we have enough time to cover everything I'd like to see change.
Certainly.
But you're exactly right. So there are a lot of people in need, and there are a lot of programs available. However, as you pointed out, there's this gap that exists between people that can get resources and those that can't, and then those that can afford, the rising cost of groceries. So those are the people that we focus on the most. And I don't mean that to sound that we don't focus on everyone, but we know there are very few resources that exist for that pocket of people. So we're really proud to say that we want everyone to come in and we want to serve everyone with dignity and respect. And we don't want anyone to feel ashamed. We've all been in different areas of need in our life. So I would like to see there be, some type of rolling off process or step down, to assistance. Everyone has a different income, therefore needs different programs and assistance. And food is just, everyone has the right to eat and eat well.
Right.
And that's something that we would love to work with, activists and lawmakers to try to get that to change to where they help people who don't qualify for the full, assistance package from the government.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that that's maybe the biggest challenge or the biggest hurdle for an organization like yours? Is that the fact that some people just do not view food as a human right or as a necessity for so many?
Yes. I think that there are there's a lot of stigma around food pantries and the people in need. For example, a lot of people that we serve downtown Toledo, that are unhoused, everyone thinks that it's because they're on drugs. They're on drugs, they're alcoholics, it's their fault. Now, I've met plenty of people that are there because of those circumstances. I've even met people that don't want to get off the street. That's what they're comfortable with. It's where they've been for years. And if that's what they want, then that's fine. But there are more families I've met that become homeless because of one catastrophic event.
Right.
Whether that is the loss of a job. I actually met a family a couple of years after I started Food for Thought. A gentleman would come down on Saturdays by himself and pick up a few lunches. He said he had some kids. Eventually, he started bringing the kids with him a few Saturdays in. And I guess got comfortable talking with us and shared that his wife had been diagnosed with leukemia. He eventually lost his job from taking off so much time to care for her, and the kids were young. So it was, first we got rid of cable, then we got rid of our cell phones, then we got rid of this and that, and eventually he lost his job. And they were living in their van. And it was just, as a mother, it was just heartbreaking to think that, how many of us are a paycheck or two away from being in that same exact situation if something happens, whether, it's an illness, a loss of a job, caring for someone else in your family because of that. So when I tell people that and I ask them to think about how long they could last if they didn't have supports, no grandparents, aunts, uncles, people that could come to their rescue, how long could you make it on what you have? And you really see people start to think like, ooh, maybe not so long, So, it's I think there's a real stigma and a real misunderstanding about what causes people to be in their situation.
And it's really difficult to understand why so many people feel so disconnected from those stories, because mm-hmm. every person I know is at least one paycheck closer to ending up in significantly more difficult circumstances yep. than they are from, say, hitting it big, quote unquote.
Oh, yeah.
And so do you think that that's a big part of it, is that people maybe have a pride about themselves that they assume they never will need support?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I mean, we all think it won't be us. It's just like when your parents tell you to drive carefully or, don't get in cars with strangers, it's because, it'll never happen to me. And everyone feels that way about, I think, becoming homeless or being in a situation where you have to ask for help. It won't be me. And what we don't know just makes us uncomfortable. And I've learned that throughout my years of this work. If you're unfamiliar with something, you shy away from it and it just makes you uncomfortable. So you don't want to know. And that just, it just adds to the, the ignorance of certain situations. So,
and that's kind of the dark underbelly of this country, is that the majority of people have to work paycheck to paycheck mm-hmm. in order to meet basic needs. And it hasn't always been that way.
No, not at all. We've had years where gas has been high, and then there's some years it's energy that's high, and
right.
some years it's water. But since 2022, everything has risen and stayed there. And that's, I say that because that's been our biggest jump, not even during COVID. Everyone was giving out food during COVID, which was wonderful. It was needed. But we saw our biggest jump from 2022 to 2023, and it was directly related to the increase in everything, just day-to-day living, medicine, everything. We started serving, in 1 year, we jumped up almost 40%.
Wow.
In the number of people we serve. So our 10 mobile food pantries right now serves almost 900 families a month in just the Lucas County area. So it's the need is great, and I think greater than people think right in their own backyard.
And you had made a great point earlier in that the need exists outside of just downtown Toledo, mm-hmm. where Food for Thought started. The need is in many other communities in Lucas County. And so what has that process been like in meeting those communities and getting to know them and, of course, serving them with the resources that you have as an organization?
Yeah, that's honestly, that's been a little more challenging than I would have thought. And I think it's also, it goes back to, I don't think there's need here, you know. So I have to run the statistics for them and take it to them and say, look, according to what I know about, let's say, South Toledo, Maumee area, you would think there wouldn't be a big need, because usually when people think need, they're thinking, okay, 75% of people living under the poverty line and whatever. But the group of people that are living in this area are living paycheck to paycheck. So we can serve the community together if we can set up a food pantry that has no restrictions, where anyone can come in and get service. And so we strategically place our food pantries around the area so we can hit those outlying areas, Holland, East Toledo, Oregon, South Toledo, North Toledo, West End, you know. So we're purposeful in that, so that way our reach is wide, because we know it exists out there. We know it's there. So
yeah, the data tells a story. Mm-hmm. And what is typically the reaction that you get from individuals who otherwise wouldn't interact with Food for Thought? Are they oftentimes surprised by the fact that they're having an interaction with your organization, or have they never expected to?
As a patron, as someone who needs food, do you mean? Yes. Yeah, you can tell those people. As soon as they walk in the door, they're very hesitant, trepidation. They're not sure how to navigate this system. And another thing about Food for Thought, and I know this from going to, you know, other food pantries over the years, we really take our time to get to know the people that come to us, because we don't want anyone to feel ashamed. It's hard enough to reach out for help. You shouldn't be ashamed to come in and pick up some groceries for your family, you know, and it's the stories that we've heard over the years, and the people that are just so grateful for us being there, is why we keep doing what we do. I mean, we know it's always going to be a need, unfortunately. So while we're happy to see that we're serving more people, on the other hand, I'm sad that I'm serving more people, because we don't want there to be that need. We want to go out of business so that way there isn't this need for food, that everyone has access and can afford it. So,
and you mentioned that need has only continued to grow. Do mm-hmm. you ever see that plateauing, or is this the expectation that things are going to get worse?
I don't see it going away, unfortunately. I really don't. In the 25 years I've been in this line of work, and the need that's out there, and not just with food and insecurity, I've worked for disease specific organizations, but you know, as long as people are suffering in whatever way it is, there are going to be organizations that want to do more for that, you know, whatever that is. And as long as things keep rising and the cost of living keeps going up and we stay in this somehow bubble that has been created, there's going to be this problem around food and the access, you know, and it's specifically to fresh food. You know, that's another thing that's very important to Food for Thought, is not just canned foods, you know, that we can get and we're grateful for, but fresh produce and healthy produce and produce that we would choose for our own families. You know, the rule, and my staff and volunteers will tell you, if you wouldn't pick it for yourself, do not put it on the pantry. Do not let it go out the door, because we want to be proud of what we're serving people. Someone in need doesn't deserve to get secondhand or picked over or leftovers. They deserve to be able to pick fresh food that you would take for your family. So, you know, we're very committed to making sure we have frozen protein, frozen meat, dairy products, gallon milk, eggs, butter, cheese, and, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables. So,
and I certainly think that that's something we should spend more time on, because I think one thing people don't realize, given where they're located or where their neighborhood is, if you live close to a grocery store, you're privileged in that sense, because a lot of people live in food deserts. Exactly. And the food that is accessible is food that is cheap, food that is not good for the body. And so what is the role of that challenge in just addressing food insecurity, the fact that some people just simply aren't able to access healthy, fresh food?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest barriers is transportation, you know, getting to. It's funny because even this afternoon when I stopped for gas, I was waiting for a receipt that wouldn't come out at the pump. And I looked over and there was this really sad little fruit stand. And it had two peaches in it. I don't know how long they'd been there. And it had six bananas. Two were still very green and the others really needed to be thrown away yesterday. And I thought, these are the choices that people that can't get to a full grocery store, this is their choice. And it's no wonder that we're staying ill and sick because we don't have access to fresh food and people are too far from a full grocery store. And so that's another one of the points, you know, when we're looking for spaces to be is, are we more than a mile from a full grocery store so we can bridge that gap? And are we on a bus line so that people can take the bus to us and get to us and get back home?
Yeah, and that's just so concerning because people do want healthy food. They want food that they can feed their family and be glad that they're feeding their family that food, but in many cases simply can't access it. So do you feel like Food for Thought is kind of filling that gap, even though it's certainly a large gap?
Yeah, I really do. I really do feel that we're doing a good job filling that gap because we are so intentional about where we serve and where we start our food pantry locations, and then also the food that we serve. I think that it's, you know, we really are paying attention to what people want. We do surveys every other year of the people that visit us, anonymous surveys, so they can let us know what is important to them and what, so that way we're not telling them what they need. They're telling us, you know, so we can continue to meet the need of what people want. Yeah.
And that's not something that exists with every nonprofit. In some cases, the approach is essentially, for lack of a better word to put it, just accept what we offer and mm-hmm. ask no questions about it. Not every nonprofit does the work to actually explore what specifically the need is. And so is that something that you would say is different with Food for Thought, is that there's an actual assessment of what the need is before trying to solve it?
Yeah. I don't want to say that other nonprofits don't do their due diligence and do good work because, you know, every nonprofit exists for a reason. I want us to be able to complement other food pantries, if that makes sense, not compete. There's no reason we should all be offering the same thing. So that was the reason why we started doing the surveys, was what are we missing? Is there something people want that we're not picking up on? You know, and over again, it's thank you for the fresh produce. Thank you for the variety that we're getting. Thank you for the gallon milk instead of the powdered milk or the shelf-stable milk, you know, and for the shredded cheese and you know, different things. So I think it's important that we're paying attention to what the need is out there, but then we're communicating with one another and making sure that we're not duplicating services because the need is so great. So why don't we all do something a little different and then be able to, you know, complete the need as much as possible.
Right. And looking at what the needs have been, what are some of the lessons that you've learned as executive director that you're hoping to take with you into this new year?
You know, really, patience, you know, things take time. You know, good work takes time, especially if you want to do it correctly. And that's not always been a strong suit of mine. But also just, I think, gratefulness that we have such a great community. You know, really, Toledo is a wonderfully giving community. There are so many fantastic philanthropic, you know, companies in this town that are really stepping up to volunteer, to really get out there and see what the need is and not just write a check towards it, but to actually come and volunteer and meet the people that we serve and see firsthand their dollars at work. You know, so I'm so, so grateful for the community in stepping up to all of these challenges that we have. I mean, I really couldn't ask for a better place to be right now, given the circumstances, because we're pretty fortunate here in Toledo.
Certainly. Well, Tanya Scherf is the executive director of Food for Thought. Tanya, thanks again for coming on the show. I'm Jaden Jefferson. You're listening to Toledo Works.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.
The views and opinions expressed in The Local Thread are those of the hosts of the program and its guests. They do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WGTE Public Media.